Chapter 8. Police had ordered the Italian from the neighborhood. But cousin Joseph, thereafter, languished, had herbs, and lost his taste for toast and buttermilk. The doctor called in a colleague, and the consultation amused and excited the old man. He became once more an important figure. The medical men reassured the family too completely. And to the patient they recommended a more varied diet, advised him to take whatever tempted him. And so one day, tremulously, prayerfully, he decided on a tiny bit of melon. It was brought up with ceremony, and consumed in the presence of the housekeeper and a hovering cousin, and 20 minutes later he was dead. But you remember the circumstances, Granis went on. How suspicion turned at once on the Italian. In spite of the hint the police had given him, he had been seen hanging about the house since the scene. It was said that he had tender relations with the kitchen maid, and the rest seemed easy to explain. But when they looked round to ask him for the explanation, he was gone clean out of sight. He had been warned to leave Renfield, and he had taken the warning so to heart that no one ever laid eyes on him again. Granis paused. He had dropped into a chair opposite the lawyer's, and he sat for a moment, his head thrown back, looking about the familiar room. Everything in it had grown grimacing and alien, and each strange insistent object seemed craning forward from its place to hear him. It was I who put the stuff in the melon, he said. Andy, I don't want you to think I'm sorry for it. This isn't remorse, understand. I'm glad the old skinflint is dead, I'm glad the others have their money. But mine's no use to me anymore. My sister married miserably, and died. And I've never had what I wanted. Asham continued to stare, then he said, what on earth was your object then? Why, to get what I wanted, what I fancied was in reach. I wanted change, rest, life, for both of us wanted, above all, for myself, the chance to write. I traveled, got back my health, and came home to tie myself up to my work. And I've slaved at it steadily for 10 years without reward, without the most distant hope of success. Nobody will look at my stuff. And now I'm 50, and I'm beaten, and I know it. His chin dropped forward on his breast. Want to chuck the whole business, he ended. 3. It was after midnight when Asham left. His hand on Granis's shoulder, as he turned to go, district attorney be hanged. See a doctor. He had cried, and so, with an exaggerated laugh, had pulled on his coat and departed. Granis turned back into the library. It had never occurred to him that Asham would not believe his story. For 3 hours he had explained, elucidated, patiently and painfully gone over every detail, but without once breaking down the iron incredulity of the lawyer's eye. At first Asham had feigned to be convinced, but that, as Granis now perceived, was simply to get him to expose himself, to entrap him into contradictions. And when the attempt failed, when Granis triumphantly met and refuted each disconcerting question, the lawyer dropped the mask suddenly and said with a good-humored laugh, by Jove, Granis, you'll write a successful play yet. The way you've worked this all out is a marvel. Granis swung about furiously. That last sneer about the play inflamed him. Was all the world in a conspiracy to deride his failure? I did it, he muttered sullenly, his rage spending itself against the impenetrable surface of the other's mockery. And Asham answered with a smile, ever read any of those books on hallucination? I've got a fairly good medico-legal library. I could send you one or two if you like. Left alone, Granis cowered down in the chair before his writing table. He understood that Asham thought him off his head. Good God, what, if they all think me crazy? The horror of it broke out over him in a cold sweat. He sat there and shook, his eyes hidden in his icy hands. But gradually, as he began to rehearse his story for the 1000th time, he saw again how incontrovertible it was, and felt sure that any criminal lawyer would believe him. That's the trouble. A sham's not a criminal lawyer. And then he's a friend. What a fool I was to talk to a friend. Even if he did believe me, he'd never let me see it. His instinct would be to cover the whole thing up. But in that case, if he did believe me, he might think it a kindness to get me shut up in an asylum. Granis began to tremble again. Good heaven! If he should bring in an expert, one of those damned alienists. A sham and pedalo can do anything, their word always goes. If a sham drops a hint that I'd better be shut up, I'll be in a straitjacket by tomorrow. And he'd do it from the kindest motives, be quite right to do it, if he thinks I'm a murderer. The vision froze him to his chair. He pressed his fists to his bursting temples and tried to think. For the first time he hoped that a sham had not believed his story. But he did. I can see it now. I noticed what a queer eye he cocked at me. Good God, what shall I do? He started up and looked at the clock. 1:30. What if a sham should think the case urgent, rout out an alienist, and come back with him? Granis jumped to his feet, and his sudden gesture brushed the morning paper from the table. Mechanically he stooped to pick it up, and the movement started a new train of association. He sat down again, and reached for the telephone book in the rack by his chair. Give me 3:10. Yes. The new idea in his mind had revived his flagging energy. He would act at once. It was only by thus planning ahead, committing himself to some unavoidable line of conduct, that he could pull himself through the meaningless days. Each time he reached a fresh decision, it was like coming out of a foggy, weltering sea into a calm harbor with lights. One of the queerest phases of his long agony was the intense relief produced by these momentary lulls. That the office of the investigator? Yes? Give me Mr. Denver, please. Hello, Denver. Yes, Hubert Granis. Just caught you? Going straight home? Can I come and see you? Yes, now. Have a talk? It's rather urgent. Yes, might give you some first-rate copy. Apostrophe. All right. He hung up the receiver with a laugh. It had been a happy thought. To call up the editor of the Investigator, Robert Denver, was the very man he needed. Granis put out the lights. In the library it was odd how the automatic gestures persisted. Went into the hall, put on his hat and overcoat, and let himself out of the flat. In the hall, a sleepy elevator boy blinked at him, and then dropped his head on his folded arms. Granis passed out into the street. At the corner of Fifth Avenue he hailed a crawling cab, and called out an uptown address. The long thoroughfare stretched before him, dim and deserted, like an ancient avenue of tombs. But from Denver's house a friendly beam fell on the pavement, and as Granis sprang from his cab the editor's electric turned the corner. The two men grasped hands, and Denver, feeling for his latch key, ushered Granis into the brightly lit hall. Disturb me? Not a bit. You might have, at 10 tomorrow morning. But this is my liveliest hour. You know my habits of old. Granis had known Robert Denver for 15 years, watched his rise through all the stages of journalism to the Olympian pinnacle of the Investigator's editorial office. In the thick-set man with grizzling hair there were few traces left of the hungry-eyed young reporter who, on his way home in the small hours, used to ob in on Granis, while the latter sat grinding at his plays. Denver had to pass Granis's flat on the way to his own, and it became a habit, if he saw a light in the window, and Granis's shadow against the blind, to go in, smoke a pipe, and discuss the universe. Well, this is like old times, a good old habit reversed. The editor smote his visitor genially on the shoulder. Eminds me of the nights when I used to rout you out. How's the play, by the way? There is a play, I suppose? It's as safe to ask you that as to say to some men. How's the baby? Apostrophe, Denver laughed good-naturedly, and Granis thought how thick and heavy he had grown. It was evident, even to Granice's tortured nerves, that the words had not been uttered in malice, and the fact gave him a new measure of his insignificance. Denver did not even know that he had been a failure. The fact hurt more than the sham's irony. "Come in, come in." The editor led the way into a small cheerful room, where there were cigars and decanters. He pushed an armchair toward his visitor, and dropped into another with a comfortable groan. "Now, then, help yourself. And let's hear all about it." He beamed at Granice over his pipe bowl, and the latter, lighting his cigar, said to himself, "Success makes men comfortable, but it makes them stupid." Then he turned, and began, "Denver, I want to tell you," the clock ticked rhythmically on the mantelpiece. The little room was gradually filled with drifting blue layers of smoke, and through them the editor's face came and went like the moon through a moving sky. Once the hour struck, then the rhythmical ticking began again. The atmosphere grew denser and heavier, and beads of perspiration began to roll from Granice's forehead. "Do you mind if I open the window?" "No. It is stuffy in here." "Wait, I'll do it myself." Denver pushed down the upper sash, and returned to his chair. "I'll go on," he said, filling another pipe. His composure exasperated Granice. "There's no use in my going on, if you don't believe me." The editor remained unmoved. "Ho says I don't believe you? And how can I tell till you've finished?" Granice went on, ashamed of his outburst. "Tea was simple enough, as you will see. From the day the old man said to me, 'Those Italians would murder you for a quarter,' I dropped everything, and just worked at my scheme. It struck me at once, that I must find a way of getting to Renfield and back in a night, and that led to the idea of a motor. A motor that never occurred to you? You wonder where I got the money, I suppose. Well, I had $1,000 or so put by, and I nosed around till I found what I wanted, a second-hand racer. I knew how to drive a car, and I tried the thing, and found it was all right. Times were bad, and I bought it for my price, and stored it away. Where? Why, in one of those no-questions-asked garages where they keep motors that are not for family use. I had a lively cousin who had put me up to that Dodge, and I looked about till I found a queer hole, where they took in my car like a baby in a foundling asylum. Then I practiced running to Renfield and back in a night. I knew the way pretty well, for I'd done it often with the same lively cousin, and in the small hours too. The distance is over 90 miles, and on the third trial I did it under 2 hours. But my arms were so lame, that I could hardly get dressed the next morning. Well, then came the report about the Italians' threats, and I saw I must act at once. I meant to break into the old man's room, shoot him, and get away again. It was a big risk, but I thought I could manage it. Then we heard that he was ill, that there had been a consultation. Perhaps the fates were going to do it for me. Good Lord, if that could only be, Granice stopped, and wiped his forehead. The open window did not seem to have cooled the room. Then came word that he was better, and the day after, when I came up from my office, I found Kate laughing over the news that he was to try a bit of melon. The housekeeper had just telephoned her all Renfield was in a flutter. The doctor himself had picked out the melon, one of the little French ones, that are hardly bigger than a large tomato, and the patient was to eat it at his breakfast the next morning. In a flash I saw my chance. It was a bare chance, no more. But I knew the ways of the house. I was sure the melon would be brought in overnight and put in the pantry icebox. If there were only one melon in the icebox, I could be fairly sure it was the one I wanted. Melons didn't lie around loose in that house. Everyone was known, numbered, catalogued. The old man was beset by the dread that the servants would eat them, and he took 100 mean precautions to prevent it. Yes, I felt pretty sure of my melon. And poisoning was much safer than shooting. It would have been the devil, and all to get into the old man's bedroom without his rousing the house. but I ought to be able to break into the pantry without much trouble. It was a cloudy night, to everything served me. I dined quietly, and sat down at my desk. Kate had one of her usual headaches, and went to bed early. As soon as she was gone, I slipped out. I had got together a sort of disguised red beard and queer-looking ulster. I shoved them into a bag, and went round to the garage. There was no one there, but a half-drunken machinist whom I'd never seen before. That served me too. They were always changing machinists, and this new fellow didn't even bother to ask if the car belonged to me. It was a very easy-going place. Well, I jumped in, ran up Broadway, and let the car go as soon as I was out of Harlem. Dark as it was, I could trust myself to strike a sharp pace. In the shadow of a wood I stopped a second, and got into the beard and ulster. Then away again. It was just 11:30 when I got to Renfield. I left the car in a dark lane behind the Lenman place, and slipped through the kitchen garden. The melon houses winked at me through the dark. I remember thinking that they knew what I wanted to know. By the stable a dog came out growling, but he nosed me out, jumped on me, and went back. The house was as dark as the grave. I knew everybody went to bed by 10. But there might be a prowling servant. The kitchen maid might have come down to let in her Italian. I had to risk that, of course. I crept around by the back door, and hid in the shrubbery. Then I listened. It was all as silent as death. I crossed over to the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.